Okay, this is session 264. I'm here to introduce our speaker. The topic will be From Camp of Israel to Good Neighbors, Stages of Growth and Organization. John Targin is our speaker tonight, Associate Professor of Management, CSU. What does that stand for?
California State University.
California State University in Bakersfield, California. Received his bachelor's degree in social economics from BYU in 1979. Received his MBA in Kellogg School, Northwestern, in Chicago in 1982. Received his PhD in management from the University of Utah. He's published in Dialogue and Sunstone. He's currently received the Faculty and Leadership Service Award from his college.
It's that award, so I could have.
And his wife, Janet, is a math professor at Bakersfield College. He has two daughters. Kristen is a UCLA student, and Aaron, a sophomore in high school. So please welcome John Targin.
Oh, thank you. Especially from the bottom of my heart of the three people who aren't related to me who are here in the room with us. First of all, a couple of disclaimers. One is I've been traveling a lot over the last 2 days, so if I kind of zone out or something, give me a high five or wave to me and wake me up a little bit. But I'm glad you've all worked out your post-lunch stupor. You know, I swore I'd never teach in the 1 o'clock time slot again at school or ever early afternoon because everybody's usually asleep, even more so than they would be otherwise. But I'm a professional teacher, and it gives me pause when we come in here and we use the worst possible pedagogy. We stick people in a room where it's kind of stuffy and all the rest, have them sit there and try and listen without any visual aids or anything else. But I do have a visual aid for you. I knew I didn't want to drag my PowerPoint equipment here, although at the last Sunstone Symposium in Los Angeles, I'll put in a plug if anybody's listening to this. I'll tell Albert later. But let's get some more visual aids up here. I usually ask for an overhead projector, and I have transparencies, but I noticed the person who was here before said it never came, so I'll give you a handout. But anyway, a plug for being a little more active. But in that same regard, interrupt me while I'm speaking or reading if you have a question or a comment. It's a small group. We can easily accommodate questions during. I mean, I say that to my classes, and nobody ever
must do.
Well, you know, it's a sign of something. Here, can you pass those out?
Oh, yes,
either the best or the worst of Mormon that I ran in the bathroom and put on appropriate upper clothing and inner clothing and all the rest before speaking at Sunstone. I don't know, it's part of the training, the tradition, whatever. But maybe it shows the strength of our culture. I'm going to allude to a couple of cultural things in here. But I'm going to go ahead and start reading. If you have a question or a comment, just stop me and maybe I'll... the other thing I was going to say, get it off my chest while I'm here. For the first time, I got a complete paper in with diagrams and all the rest early for a respondent to look at. And there's no respondent today. So it's up to you to either tear this apart or share some anecdotes or get to your next session early. Okay. Several years ago, I presented a paper on the growth and maturation of the church. The model developed by others that I adapted for the paper and used for the framework of my analysis has been updated, and since then, the church has experienced further change and development. I'm not quite sure where the title of in the program came from. I looked at it again. I said, I don't think I wrote that, but anyway, if I did, I can only assume it came to me in a scholarly fog. What I propose to do today is introduce a model of growth which describes the maturation of almost all successful organizations, describe the stages of growth the church has gone through, as I see them, and finish with some analysis of what may be the biggest challenges facing the church if it is going to continue being successful in terms of growth and development. I should emphasize that one of the reasons that this paper may be of interest is that the church has met most of the challenges that accompany growth and progress through several stages and can therefore be considered an organizational success. While there are many yardsticks of success and many factors that contribute to the success of an organization, I am focusing on continued growth in terms of membership. And in organizational studies, when they talk about the growth of an organization, it's not a number of cornflakes they sell. I'm a graduate of the Kellogg School. or assets or anything like that. It's usually in terms of number of people as a part of that organization, corporations, number of employees. The use of other, perhaps more appropriate measures is of great interest to me, but is left for another time, perhaps during the question and answer period. And I'll refer back to something else because it's happened to me again. I once did a paper that was in Sunstone called, what was it, Goal Displacement in the Church or Why Did They Carpet the Gym? It used to be in, some of you may be familiar with, Garden Park Ward. In this beautiful building with Minerva Teicher pictures up in the chapel and stadium seating and this beautiful cultural hall with a nice wood floor and they put carpet on it. Well, that just happened to our not-so-beautiful floor in Bakersfield. But anyway, talking about what measures we use to look at our success and whether it's appropriate to have it easy to clean or whether it should be aesthetic and useful and all the rest. Okay, let me get to my paper. All organizations go through developmental stages as they grow and progress. The interesting thing is that almost all types of organizations, at least within Western cultural settings, go through similar developmental stages. Many never progress. By the way, did everyone get a handout? Okay. Many never progress through all of the stages. In fact, the vast majority of organizations eventually stagnate and decline or cease to function before fully maturing. Only exceptionally adaptive organizations persist. One of the most useful models of organizational growth has arisen from the work of Daff, Quinn, and Cameron, and Greiner. I have adapted their work into the model I'm presenting here today, and that's figure one, the one that's got less detail on it. Which, and the other thing I thought was interesting is one of these, how many scholars are quoted here? Four. One of them is a church member, and quite a name in the field of organizational studies. And there are quite a few people in terms of business that have made a name for themselves in organizational behavior. And I think that is maybe that we grow up in an organization that's very successful and dynamic. And I was attracted to the field because it helped me to understand my experiences. And of course, when I was young and naive, I thought, well, I'll study and learn how to make the church better. I will be using this diagram as a reference during this portion of my presentation. One thing that must be kept in mind as I explain the phases of organizational growth is that organizations do not necessarily progress in an orderly fashion through all of the stages and remain in a given stage for an indefinite period of time. The first stage of development that organizations experience is the entrepreneurial stage. It usually begins with an innovative visionary leader who senses a need in the social environment that is currently not being met. He or she founds an organization in order to meet that need. A popular example is the founding of Apple Computer, which initiated the personal computer industry. The early days are a time of great energy and organizational commitment on the part of the members. The leader is the main driving force and is in constant contact with each of the organization's members. Organizational success depends mainly upon this person's creative energy and vision. If the organization continues to be successful, problems arise because of growth. The founder soon becomes overburdened with decision-making and supervisory responsibilities. No longer do all organizational members have the opportunity to interact with the founder on a frequent basis, to have problems resolved, or to receive help. This situation is known as the crisis of leadership. Have any of you worked for a small business with a founder? Any of you have? Or have founded your own organization? You know, it's a very big issue to delegate, to give up some of that, because people give up some of their persona, some of their identity, and they're very hesitant to do so. It's almost as if when they retire or they die or when somebody takes over, that part of their life ceases. It arises when the founder becomes overextended and fails to provide enough hands-on direction to other organization members. The early Christian church faced this crisis when missionary efforts were extremely successful and outstripped the apostles' ability to effectively oversee the burgeoning membership. If an organization is to grow and prosper, it must progress into the collectivity stage. This is accomplished either by having the founder step out of the creative role and concentrate on management, which is unlikely, or by recruiting an individual with a strong directive leadership style to take over the administration of the organization. Organizational progress depends upon finding someone to fill this leadership role. Paul was such a leader. His tireless hands-on style combined with his prolific letter writing helped to keep the early church functioning effectively and growing. After his death, it was many years before power was again consolidated into the office of the Bishop of Rome and the church was unified. The same strong directive leadership style that is effective in most organizations during their early life is often not the same type of leadership style which will serve them as they become medium-sized operations. Organization members develop unique skills and capabilities. The range of activities expands, as does the population being served. New products or services are added. No one person can possess all of the knowledge, skills, and insights necessary to direct all of the organization's activities. Members begin to demand more freedom to make decisions, which require their unique knowledge and insight. This is known as the crisis of autonomy. Some people have concluded that a main factor in the downfall of the Roman, English, French, and other empires was the inability of these very structured, centralized societies to adapt to the diverse needs and problems encountered in their far-flung domains. Widespread diversity can only be addressed when some of the authority previously reserved for the leader or leaders at the top of the organizational pyramid is relinquished to persons at lower levels. This is known as decentralization of decision-making. However, complete control cannot be handed over to local leadership, or is that centrifugal or centrifugal? It looks like you pronounce it centrifugal? It sure doesn't look like that, but it wouldn't let me write centrifugal in the spell check. Forces would soon tear the organization apart. For this reason, rules and regulations subject to local application are developed. Local leaders are held responsible for results and adherence to policies and procedures, even as they are given more autonomy. Decentralization with control is essential in large organizations which provide a large variety of products and services or which exist in a rapidly changing environment. The modern Roman Catholic Church is a good example of an organization that has allowed change in regional diversity to address local conditions, even if it has been done grudgingly. Practices, rituals, and even doctrinal interpretations vary widely across Europe, the United States, Africa, and Latin America. While the current pope seems intent on reasserting central control and instilling more standardization worldwide, his efforts in this regard have been largely ineffective. The British Empire is an excellent example of an organization that met the challenges of controlling its widespread constituent parts through the extensive use of formal rules, procedures, and reporting practices. The same organizations, practices, and procedures were evident in India, South Africa, the Western Hemisphere, etc. The Home Office constantly sent visitors to check up on progress and to make sure that strategies and policies were being followed, which worked for the benefit of the kingdom or empire. As organizations continue to grow, coordinating mechanisms tend to grow and multiply. A few simple rules, procedures, and reports bloomed into myriad complex rules, procedures, and reports. Mid-level managers often begin to complain that they are being stifled in their efforts and that it is difficult to get anything done. This is known as the crisis of red tape. It occurs in all organizations that become increasingly bureaucratic as they become large and struggle with coordination. One need look only as far as the nearest federal or state agency for a prime example of an organization mired in red tape and unable to get things done or get things accomplished expeditiously or at all. And, of course, when I talk about this to my students, immediately we think of the Department of Motor Vehicles. I don't know if you have that experience, but many organizations never recover from the crisis of red tape. However, if organizations are to maintain vitality and continue to be effective as they grow, they must find alternate ways to coordinate their activities. The primary way in which this is done is through shared values and teamwork. Shared values and teamwork connote cooperation while at the same time allow for some individual initiative. Unit leaders participate in give and take. While they are concerned with the success of their individual units, they also have internalized the goals of the organization as a whole and act cooperatively to maintain a balance between the two. In fact, the need to cut red tape while simultaneously retaining cooperation between units has resulted in greatly increased attention to the development of organizational values and has spawned the organizational culture consulting business. They actually have people go in and diagnose listen to the stories people tell and the symbols and the ceremonies and all that and diagnose what type of a culture do you have and is it appropriate for the environment or the technology or history of your organization. Procter & Gamble is an example of an organization which is widely diversified, producing hundreds of household products in dozens of countries. Yet decisions are made consistent with corporate goals and values without the need for a lot of red tape or overly burdensome formal coordination mechanisms. Research, production, marketing, and distribution units all cooperate even when their individual unit goals may suffer slightly. Many organizations can conceivably continue to grow and be successful almost indefinitely if they resolve their coordination problems and progress into true teamwork. However, environments change. Organizations in dynamic environments also need to change if they are to remain viable. Failure to address environmental change can lead to a crisis of stagnation. Many organizations may find themselves mired in this type of crisis even if they have not progressed through all of the earlier stages. Eventually, all organizations will reach this point if they do not, in quotes, die first. The U.S. steel, electronics, and automotive industries all contain organizations that have found themselves in stagnation. Stagnation is the point in an organization's history, a crossroads, which all large successful organizations eventually face, or most of them do anyway. Three paths lie ahead for large mature organizations that encounter potential stagnation: decline, continued maturity, or revitalization through thinking small. The least desirable path, which unfortunately is very commonly trod, is decline. There's a new branch of organizational studies that deals with organizational decline. The reason that this stream of research is viable is that there's such a large sample of mature organizations that are failing to adapt. Scholars have identified telltale signs and symptoms of a declining organization. I'm not going to attempt to diagnose the church using that list, but interestingly, one factor leading to eventual decline is great success in the past, coupled with an unwillingness to change basic assumptions and practices. In the rare cases of organizations whose environment remains relatively stable and benevolent, continued organizational maturity and success is possible. However, it is unclear how long this can continue for even the most successful organizations. The innovative and vibrant Apple computers and Microsofts of yesterday easily become the arrogant and reactive companies of today. If history is a guide, the only sure way to overcome stagnation in the long run is through some type of revitalization, through restructuring, to give increased discretion and autonomy to subunits. In fact, true revitalization may be impossible in large monolithic organizations. Organizations which have successfully adapted have taken the form of a confederation of linked independent units. And one of the new organizational forms is very successful in terms of multinational corporations. They draw as a picture that looks like a spider web. You have a bunch of circles all over, and there's a confederation, but no true hierarchy, no true headquarters. It's through cooperation that they continue to grow. Yes? DAFT is an author. It's actually taken out of his textbook, where he adapted it from some of the work of the others. It's actually a revision from the last version of his textbook. But organization theory. Richard DAFT, who is now at he's moved around. I think is it Vanderbilt? DAFT. And then Greiner has a model of growth. Greiner. And let's see, who's the other one I referred to? Is at Harvard now. And Quinn, I keep thinking Michael, but it's Quinn and Cameron did some work. But anyway, this model he's gone through several iterations. The paper I did about 10 years ago used the old model, and it seemed like it worked pretty well too, but it's been updated. Organization theory. Mm-hmm. And it's by Southwest Publishers now. It used to be by West, and I think the 7th edition is... It was supposed to be waiting for me when I got back from vacation yesterday, or when I was in Bakersfield yesterday, but didn't get there yet. Okay. Okay, we're talking about the loosely linked units. Rubbermaid and 3M are examples of organizations which continue to adapt and innovate through the adoption of a small company persona while maintaining the strength of large organizational resources. And that seems to be the formula for success. You have small units where people are accountable, they feel an investment and identify with the smaller unit, while at the same time can draw on the expertise and the financial resources and the physical resources, plant and equipment of a large organization. Can't remember. Small company persona. No? Is that that's the phrase? The church's development has closely followed the model I have presented, I think. A major factor contributing to the church's growth and success has been its ability to overcome, to at least some extent, each of the organizational crises it has faced. And then there's figure two if you want to flip it over. And if somebody's listening to this tape, however unlikely... It's a series of stair steps, and there are lines going up that says growth and growth from whatever reason, and then the level parts or the crises that may or may not be overcome. Okay, starting with the entrepreneurial stage. Few people would have trouble identifying Joseph Smith as the creative visionary founder of the church. In fact, I'll try and make reference to it. The one thing I did leave off of this figure two with the Mormon church stuff overlaid on it were the leaders that I think kind of symbolize these periods or gave energy to them. And the first one obviously would be Joseph Smith, if you want to write them down. The second one, the collectivity stage, would be Brigham Young. The statehood era under formalization, I think, and I'm no historian, but I would put Wilford Woodruff and Heber J. Grant there. The international era, I would put David O. McKay and Spencer Kimball. And the world church era, I'd put Gordon B. Hinckley. David and Evan Kennedy could go in the international era as well. Anyway, Joseph Smith was the entrepreneur whose charisma, force, personality, and vision fueled tremendous early growth. During the period of time that I call the Restoration Era, the majority of church members knew Joseph personally. He was constantly presenting doctrinal, economic, and organizational innovations. The organization grew as these new ideas and beliefs spread. This stage begins in 1823, about the time of the first vision, when Joseph began sharing his revelations with his immediate family, and ends when the saints left Nauvoo under the direction of the apostles. The metaphor, I believe, best describes the church at this time is growing family. Not only did members know each other as brother and sister, and the prophet's parents as mother and father Smith, but intermarriage, plural and other, bonded church members even closer as they shared trials and triumphs. The phrase, I think, best describes the philosophy of the body of the church is waiting for Christ. This was a millennial movement with great expectations of the kingdom of God rolling forth to encompass all nations and governments. While some of this theocratic philosophy extended beyond Nauvoo, it clearly was diminishing as the saints established themselves in the West. And if we have some historians, you could debate me on that. I know, was it John Taylor was the last one who was crowned king? The king of God, the Council of 50 was sort of more or less meeting, but I think it diminished pretty much once they left Nauvoo. Some people looking at me like they don't know what I'm talking about. Maybe I'm making allusions to things that I shouldn't be. Not that I shouldn't be in terms of somebody listening to the tape, although that's probably true too, but that you don't have the background. But anyway, I think that the development of a theocratic kingdom of God that was going to fill the earth, at least my interpretation is that started to subside once the prophet was killed and they were leaving Nauvoo. Okay. As the church experienced exponential growth, the administrative burdens began to overwhelm Joseph. Beginning with Kirtland in Missouri and continuing into Nauvoo, Joseph found it increasingly difficult to maintain close ties with individual members and to personally infuse them with his vision. Internal strife was rampant. He attempted to address these problems through organizational innovations, especially through priesthood callings, but he never was very successful. Even though the church continued to experience phenomenal growth during the Nauvoo period, the inability of Joseph to personally supervise many aspects of the church organization, or perhaps due to his leadership style, severe internal organizational problems arose, which only could be properly addressed through stronger, more organized leadership. Into the void stepped one of the greatest leaders in U.S. history. While Brigham Young may have lacked the creative vision of Joseph Smith, he clearly did not lack the ability or desire to provide the saints with strong, directive leadership. During most of what I have labeled the Pioneer Era, Brigham was the driving force behind the move west and the colonization of the Intermountain West. His forceful personality and unabashed use of political, economic, and religious power filled the leadership void during this period of great expansion and growth. He implemented ecclesiastical, temporal, and economic structures and innovations, which greatly contributed to the ongoing viability of the church as an organization. While doctrinal development slowed, great progress was shown in many other areas. I call this period the Pioneer Era and date it from the departure from Nauvoo until the first manifesto in 1990. The metaphor which I feel best describes this era is Camp of Israel. Indeed, by examining sermons, scriptures, and place names, it becomes clear that the saints thought of themselves as a modern-day Israel making their way through the wilderness to a promised land. The phrase which I feel best describes the predominant philosophy is separating from the world. The saints viewed the United States as an enemy standing in their path to establishing a latter-day Zion. Their flight, which is kind of interesting because some people have opposite readings on it, that very much the Constitution was divinely inspired and all the rest, but you got to remember they did flee the United States and the persecution they at least perceived, and much of it real, in several states. Their flight out of the U.S. and into Mexico was for refuge. While millennialism persisted, the challenge at hand was to build the temporal and spiritual kingdom of God. The saints strove for a gathering of the elect of the world. They viewed themselves as a peculiar people and reveled in it. If their communitarianism, flight from pluralism, strange theology, and even stranger marriage practices marked them as different from mainstream societies, so much the better. Later in the Pioneer Era, the colonization was essentially complete. Building the kingdom of God meant not so much colonization as it did the development of the programs, leaders, and individual members of the church. The leadership style, which was appropriate during relocation and colonization, was not necessarily what was needed to bring the church into its next phase of growth. The many tensions and problems experienced by Brigham during the latter years of his tenure as church president may have been as much a product of his failure to change his leadership style to meet the changing needs of the expanding church as much as it was to the building of the railroad and the influx of Gentiles into the territory. And just an aside, you may know this was a very difficult period in the 60s and 70s? And a lot of internal problems and external problems. But again, I think a lot of it had to do with leadership style rather than just the influx of Gentiles. But somebody can question me on that conclusion. A strong leader with control over even minor decisions cannot possibly keep up with the demands of an ever-expanding and evolving organization. I do not believe that the church's crisis of autonomy was ever fully resolved. While many subsequent leaders had much less directive leadership styles than Brigham, most decision-making authority continues to reside with a few leaders at the top. This may be one of the reasons that the growth of the church slowed relatively for a rather long period of time following the initial gathering. Many of the innovations and local developments that were needed to maintain the organization's progress were slower in coming than they would have been with a more decentralized leadership style. However, I believe that the church did progress into the formalization stage. This stage encompasses two very different periods, which I label the statehood era and the international era. The statehood era dates from the issuance of the first manifesto in 1890 to the involvement of America in World War II in 1941. Obviously, because that's when servicemen were abroad and converted people in different nations, and we really started the international missions in a serious way, both in Europe and in Asia. Wilford Woodruff and Heber J. Grant were key leaders during the era. During the statehood era, the hurdles to statehood were overcome, and with the issuance of the Second Manifesto, church leadership finally accepted the inevitability of coexisting with civil authority. While some growth took place in the East and South, the church remained primarily an Intermountain West church. The international era dates from 1941 to the revelation on extending the priesthood to black male members in 1978. Key leaders in this era were David O. McKay and Spencer W. Kimball. From the late 19th century to the mid-20th century, some important local innovation was fostered both in programs and organization. Beginning in the pioneer era and accelerating into the statehood and international eras, local authorities, especially state presidents, enjoyed a great deal of latitude in implementing policies and programs. Innovations such as youth programs, the welfare program, primary standardized missionary procedures, etc., came into being largely out of local developments. It was a period of experimentation and relative receptivity to new ideas and initiatives on the part of top leaders. These new innovations and the development of local leadership capabilities were needed as the isolation of the church ended and stakes were beginning to be planted outside the Great Basin. The metaphor that I think best describes these two eras is good citizens. Millennialism was increasingly downplayed. The church set out to portray itself as less peculiar, while still distinctive, in order to take the gospel to the world. Saints increasingly took part in the the economic, political, educational, and social life of America. And through the efforts of Presidents McKay and Kimball and Church Ambassador David M. Kennedy, the church began to spread to all parts of the globe, or the glove, as the case may be. I thought I caught that one. The phrase I have chosen to describe these eras is reintegrating into society, although the phrase integrating into American society may be just as apt. Catch the play. I don't know if they were really coming back or just for the first time entering, and if it's all society or just American society. Anyway, probably got that. During the 60s and 70s, the church faced unique and daunting problems. The Vietnam War, drugs, the black issue, the new morality, and the geographic dispersion of the church made for very unsettling times. Many members, including some in the highest councils of the church, felt that innovations and programs were getting out of hand and that some sort of control needed to be imposed to bring the church back into harmony with stated principles and beliefs. During the latter part of the international era, less emphasis was placed on decentralization and innovation, and relatively more emphasis was placed on control. The philosophy, policies, procedures, and organizational changes compromising this period are known collectively as the Correlation Movement. The addition of increasingly strict controls was useful to a point. Standardization of programs, materials, and buildings has resulted in great cost savings. Standardized programs and procedures were a comfort to long-term members as they became increasingly mobile and moved from unit to unit. During unsettling times, many members and potential converts needed to feel a part of a unified, coherent church and to receive more unambiguous direction in their lives. And I don't want to downplay this. I think that was very important, and I think it was appropriate for the times. The world was seen as an increasingly complex and hostile place. The church needed to exist in the world, but the members increasingly looked to it, to the church, to provide a comforting discipline and bulwark against the unpredictable shifting sands of society as a whole. The rise of the religious right and Muslim fundamentalism are manifestations of the same phenomenon. And I will take an aside, since nobody's interrupting me. I was going to say that we had a presentation on evolution a few hours ago this morning, and one of the comments I was going to make is that when I was at BYU, of course I had Duane Jeffrey as my professor, but I felt very comfortable with evolution. I didn't think that there was any problem with that. And yet my students and the people generally in the community where I live are very conservative or orthodox in that regard. Write letters to the editor all the time saying that evolution is just a theory, and my students are very literalistic in their interpretation of the Bible. So I don't think it's just within Mormondom that issues like this come up, and that we're really more reactionary than society as a whole. Clint?
Yes.
The question. Yeah, and the interesting thing is I found BYU to be very open. I know I graduated in 79, but any issue is fair game, and I guess we've gone through a little bit of a cycle where it's become a little less so. Okay, I digress. But I really do want to emphasize this, that I think worldwide, people saw in the 70s and the 80s very uncertain times, and I think there's been a pendulum swing. It's not just in American society, but in almost all societies. I mean, you look at the Taliban and a lot of movements around the world, and it'll shift back eventually, I think. But with my limited perspective, I used to think, well, the church has changed. You know, it's different now in the 60s, and sunstone is graying and all the rest. And that's a unique phenomenon to Mormonism, but I'm less convinced of that now. Standardization and formalization are really indicators of the organizational type known as bureaucracy. Bureaucracy, see if I get guilty, the connotation is always bad. Bureaucracy in and of itself is not necessarily bad. In fact, it has the capability through professionalization of leadership, uniformity of procedures, and the generation of rules to provide the control necessary for most modern organizations to function. But bureaucracy can develop to a point where both creativity and day-to-day operations are stifled, and organizational members feel that they are less important than the rules and procedures developed initially for their benefit. In other words, the crisis of red tape that I talked about earlier. Okay, as previously discussed, if organizations are going to successfully progress beyond the formalization stage, they must develop more flexible, less restrictive methods of organizational control. The church has a great advantage in developing teamwork in that its individual members have very highly developed shared values and beliefs. The climate is perfect for an atmosphere of teamwork and cooperation rather than command and regulation. However, one value or belief or value must be changed before teamwork can be a viable organizational strategy. It is the belief or value that wisdom and inspiration necessarily flow downward in the organization. This is a holdover from earlier eras when the crisis of autonomy was never fully resolved by decentralizing an appropriate amount of authority and discretion. If and when this happens, the church will be firmly planted in the elaboration stage. The period I've labeled the World Church Era dates from 1978 to the present. The embodiment of this era is President Hinckley, who has wielded a great deal of influence throughout the era. His background in public relations is ideal for getting across the metaphor which I feel best describes the church persona, good neighbors. The phrase I would use to describe it is demonstrating the fruits of the gospel. Millennialism is less emphasized than ever. Peculiarities are downplayed or removed. And you think about even design, garment. We're not supposed to talk about that. Well, anyway, fashions and birth control and all the rest. I mean, we are becoming less peculiar all the time. Do we even sing that? Didn't we used to have a hymn where they talked about being a peculiar people? Is that were those words in there? I don't remember singing that in years, if there is one. Maybe we never sang it. No? There isn't one? Something about peculiar. I remember seeing that, but maybe it's just in the Book of Mormon or somewhere. Okay. Service, personal fulfillment, righteous living, strength in families have become the message. Worldwide organization, again, it's not that Christ is coming again to restore. I mean, I guess we still have food storage, do we? But I don't hear sacrament talks about it any longer. And a lot of the other messages have been downplayed, and now we're kind of like, we're the good guys. We see the good fruits of our labors here. Federal law against food storage? Oh, hoarding, yeah. What about having a concealed weapon to guard it? No, I'm sorry. Year supply of ammunition, yeah. That always wait for Christ with your AK-47. I'm sorry if I offended anybody, but I just, as a matter of fact, we had a thing called Heelman's Camp. We had 1,800 Boy Scouts and Explorer Scouts and all this and leaders. I was there volunteering to go along in California. And one of the activities, of course, was shooting guns. And something about, I guess it's the West, it's not Mormonism and guns. But we did have an open house one time at our ward, and somebody was there with a gun. But I guess that you could have one in Utah, but it has to be concealed, right? Yeah. Trench coat with a Uzi down the sleeve? Okay. Sorry, I digressed. I apologize to anybody who's listening on this tape. All right, worldwide organizations can be distinguished from international or multinational organizations. Again, international, multinational versus worldwide, and we don't need to spend a lot of time on that, but by the extent to which they adapt to local customs and circumstances. To become truly worldwide organizations, groups must jettison many cultural and philosophical peculiarities and practices, which are not central to its mission, but make it less viable in new settings. And truly worldwide organizations are few and far between, but they typically have local managers, local production, local control, as opposed to being just a General Motors that stamps out bodies and assembles cars in Argentina or wherever. Yeah.
Where do you think the church?
Ask me that in a minute if you have a specific, but I don't think we're quite there yet. And there's been a lot of really good work about cultural peculiarities and the need to maybe do away with some of those before the church can really become worldwide. And I think that's the goal now. I don't think we're beyond the gathering stage completely. I think we've gotten over it. Or are people still counseled to come back to Zion? That's where get your kids out of here so the public schools won't be. No, all right. Okay, while the church may not have fully entered the elaboration stage, I believe that it may soon be on the threshold of a dramatic change and revitalization. However, in order to become a true world church, the organization will have to shed its Wasatch Range alter ego and truly be flexible enough to meet the needs of members and prospective members in many different cultural, political, and economic situations. The core teachings, beliefs, and practices of the church provide a core, that sounds redundant, provide comfort and hope for people throughout the world. This core needs to be elaborated and instilled in every member. But there are many teachings, beliefs, and practices which are not core and clearly do not meet the needs of many people, minor course corrections notwithstanding. New revelation may be required on the purpose of earthly life, the roles of men and women, foreordination, etc. And you can think about some of those, and maybe we can talk about them, but what might need to change. If the church truly matures into the elaboration stage, I believe that the looming crisis of stagnation will be overcome only as the church adapts its theology and becomes, in quotes again, small. By reemphasizing local experiences, autonomy, and innovation so that members identify at least as much with their ward, stake, and region as they do with church headquarters. As mentioned before, the church is currently facing two crises, red tape and autonomy. The large size of the church necessitates the generation of formal rules and regulations. It is the most effective way to maintain the standardization and control necessary for large organizations to operate efficiently. However, efficiency is often gained at the expense of effectiveness. In order to be truly effective, the church needs to be responsive to local and individual needs and conditions, as many speakers have mentioned over the years. Bureaucracy and red tape get in the way of this responsiveness. This is evidenced in the construction of marginally functional buildings, programs which can alienate or regiment rather than stimulate and uplift, lesson manuals which bore and confuse rather than challenge and inspire, and missionary efforts which can be confused with Amway programs. The lack of autonomy granted to local leaders and over-centralization of power in the church continue to cause problems of their own. One of the ways it does this is by restricting the development of local leaders, often automatons, or yes-men, rather than leaders prepared to use their own inspiration and talents to solve problems and serve. It also means retarded doctrinal development in a changing world. Changes in priesthood eligibility, garment design, the practice of polygamy, attitudes towards women, and temple ceremonies were overdue when they occurred and often insufficient to meet the needs of the times when they were made. The pronouncements of leaders in the periods leading up to the changes and immediately after give one the impression that the main holdup to the changes was the desire by those at the top to be perceived as fully in control and not willing to receive suggestions from others. A related problem is the relationships with non-mainstream groups within the church. The desire by the highest church officials to maintain control has made it more difficult for the church to deal with homosexuals, scholars, feminists, see a theme there, minority members, etc. Bad press, bad feelings, and a lack of mutual understanding have typified these interactions, President Hinckley's impressive PR efforts notwithstanding. All right, future predictions. I am optimistic about the future of the church. It has responded very successfully in the past to the organizational crises it has faced. However, it is likely that one or more visionary leader will need to arise who sense the need for change. Also, the eventual demise of the correlation cadre, that's a term my wife gave me grief on that, I won't mention by name, but Harold B. Lee disciples, will bode a more likely loosening up of the organization, which will be needed to meet the current crises. However, as the church encounters inevitable public relations problems, it may be tempting for leaders to, quote, circle the wagons, unquote, and possibly even exacerbate both the crisis of autonomy and the crisis of red tape, rather than overcoming them by emphasizing core values and teamwork. All right, finally, I have three simple suggestions for the church organization based upon my analysis. One, grant more autonomy to local units and allow local diversity and innovations. Two, rely more on internalized values to guide the membership of the church and less on reporting, rules, and procedures. Three, refocus on the ward experience as the center of the members' religious life. In conclusion, the LDS Church has been and is a strong, vibrant organization. Much of its success has been due to its ability to change and adapt to the environment in which it has existed. And I'll do an aside here again. I gave a presentation at the Miller-Eccles group down in Los Angeles. We talked about the future of the church. We actually broke out into groups, and I had a presentation, which went a lot better because I had flip charts and PowerPoint and all that stuff going. With another plug for that. But visual learning. But I concluded with something that I've always found ironic. Most of you know who Gerald and Sandra Tanner are. They're kind of internal, now external, critics of the church. And they magnum opus, the Mormonism Shadow Reality, and condensed it into a more readable version for Moody Bible Press called The Changing World of Mormonism. And I just thought, man, these guys really screwed up. For one, they wrote it to an audience that's not Mormon, but I suppose they thought Mormons would pick it up. But the criticism of the church is that it changed. My golly, it changed and adapted to meet the needs of its members. And I thought, boy, if there's anything that would, you know, it was just the opposite, you'd think they would, anyway. It's ironic. I am confident that it will eventually adapt to meet the crises of growth which face it, unlike many other ill-fated or stagnating movements. However, personalities are important. It will be interesting to see if the leaders of the future will be up to the task of guiding the church to the same extent as Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, Wilford Woodruff and Heber J. Grant, David O. McKay and Spencer W. Kimball, and Gordon B. Hinckley. I look forward to updating this paper 20 years hence. Thank you.
You have questions? What we'd like is those that have a question come up here and speak it. We'll go with you first.
Yeah, there's nothing worse than driving home in the car and listening to a tape and there's a 3-minute blank and you can't hear the people asking the question.
I just wondered if you go a little more into what this thinking small versus continued maturity means. I know you're suggesting that there were three suggestions, and that the church allow more diversity and innovation coming from lower levels and that kind of thing. Where does that fit within thinking small and continued maturity? And is one of those possibly a better route than the other?
Okay. Give me an example of an organization. Any corporation? Okay, IBM. A great example. Anybody read about Big Blues or any of the books about IBM? Well, IBM made their money building mainframe computers. And they built the best mainframe computers in the world and were great. It's like the buggy whip of the 1980s. And they continued trying to do that better and better and more efficiently than they'd ever done before. And they just couldn't do it because the environment had shifted. Now, had there still been a huge market for centralized computing using mainframe computers, IBM would still be successful at continued maturity. But it went into decline. I'm trying to think of... Which computer company would you say was very successful? Well, maybe Dell, all right? Dell changes its computer line like that. I mean, they do market research, whatever is the current trend. That's what they develop, and they meet the marketplace. They're a marketing organization, not a computer manufacturing organization. And they changed to meet. Microsoft, I think, has developed lots of small units to develop products and hasn't exercised the centralized control that maybe some of the others have, even though apparently Bill Gates is having problems dealing with the governmental environment. But in terms of consumers, they've done a fantastic job of buying companies, buying technology. So the idea of small, it's like 3M. What they'll do is have a unit of maybe at most, is that 5,000 employees? Is that when they cut it off, or is it 500? I'm feeling senile here. But anyway, what they'll do is they'll take someone and say, look, you take over this. You've got a great product idea or a way to serve customers. We'll make you the CEO. We'll give you a 20% stake. We'll provide the financing. Now go and make us a pot of money. Hire your own people. Develop the company. If you need to come back to us, fine, we'll help you, but just go do your thing, as opposed to having that person leave and start another Apple computer. So I don't know if that answered your question, but, well, the continuing maturity would be if the environment stayed the same. Think of, you know, the federal government, okay? It's continued maturity because unless there is a great desire to outsource the functions currently being provided by federal departments, I know the Republicans want to get rid of the Department of Education. They need to be careful, I think, and do a better job of meeting the demands of the environment. But they haven't so far. I think many labor unions are a threat, but as long as the current legislation, the current environment supports those institutions, they don't need to change. They've got a supportive environment that will continue supporting. But that there's a lot of competition in the religious marketplace. You know, we are not the fastest-growing church in Latin America. We're not the fastest-growing church worldwide. And I think there may become a time that if the message doesn't get more downsized and allow for local innovations, like the Catholic Church has done very well, out of necessity because the large periods of growth and missionary efforts were when communications were very difficult. But if we don't do that, we run the risk of decline rather than continued maturity, because I think the environment is changing. The world is changing. But church has met, I hope I've argued that they've met a lot of these challenges in the past. Sorry, it's a little long.
Would thinking smaller require some level of democracy? And would it also require a less sexist attitude or position?
Well, I think that's a value-related question, but as someone at least has studied a little bit about organization, I don't know about the democracy thing, because the idea is that within the confederation of a larger organization, that you allow that same type of creative energy and spirit and vision to play itself out on a smaller scale. And so perhaps you might have a visionary person in Kenya, mission president there, who adapts the church and takes the programs and allow it to grow. Wouldn't necessarily have to be a democratic person. Now, I think if anybody know where most new product ideas come from? I mean, in terms of types of people that come up with R&D labs, president of the company, it's customers, yeah. That's where they get their new product ideas. And I don't know that we're consumers necessarily. Yeah, we are consumers, obviously, of what the church provides. Like I say, my students are not customers or consumers because they don't pay for their education. But I don't know whether, I guess we pay. I won't ask you how many you're paying. But anyway, I think that those concerns need to be listened to. I don't think that in many countries equality, treating women with respect and dignity, giving them more decision-making power in the church or authority is necessary. If we want to hold on to the current crop of competent young women in the United States, like my daughter, who received a strong pitch from BYU, and I did not want to go to BYU, I think we will have to change that. But that's within the American kind of maybe middle, upper middle class, highly educated context. I'm sorry, but in most churches, I don't see women clamoring for more of a voice. I think within the realm of Sunstone, that's very much an issue. But in terms of most women that are very involved in religious organizations, yeah, in our church, I see within Sunstone. But, well, in the charismatic Christian movements, my sister happens to be a charismatic Christian, in Lutheran church, a lot of them, maybe Episcopalians is the exception, but I don't see women clamoring saying, they want security in their lives, they want husbands that don't cheat on them, they want a good religious service, they want programs for their kids. Now, I don't want to speak for all women, but that's the read that I get, is that it's really not a huge issue within most religious movements. So I don't think that that's necessary. But, you know, somebody can debate me on that one. I wish it would happen. But. Actually, while you're coming up, I'll share a story with you. I got called in when they had the, what did they call that thing? Everybody in, you know. What was that? The Purge. Yeah, Purge. Well, I got called in. Yeah, luckily I gave a paper that was, it was referred to in the Salt Lake Tribune, and they had that, the document, and highlighted and yelled, but nothing from the paper was there on record. But they did get a dialogue article on which I said, I don't see any scriptural prohibition against women preparing and passing the sacrament. You know, the priests have to bless it, right? But on the rest. And that was highlighted in yellow. That's from a couple of the general authorities. Their names were on it. I think Bill Nelson from the Helping the Members Committee was the one behind it. But strengthening, that's right. I became a lot stronger. I'm sorry.
I do have a question, but I am just commenting on the women's issue. I find that women in the church are the greatest defenders of the status quo. And until we change, I think it'll continue like it is. But I have asked over and over myself, what will cause change? And I'm disturbed about a lot of things in the church. And the only thing that I've come up with is decline. That until we reach a point where we are losing membership at a rate that is snowballing, change will not occur. And I wanted to get your comment on that.
Well, obviously, yes, I agree with you 100%. One of the things, have any of you read the... what was the new book about Mormon America? I'm going to put a plug on it. It's very well written. It's the first book by an outsider that I thought was a really good one-volume description to give to other non-Mormons. I thought it was just great. But one of the things that's evident if you read through that, I just hadn't thought about so in such an organized way is how really smart and well-educated people, the church leadership is, the highest leadership. I mean, many of them have graduate degrees now. It's changed a lot. I think President Hinckley has a degree. Anybody else have one? Any other presidents? Oh, yeah, we had a President Hunter. Yeah, in terms of presidents. But anyway, it's a very intelligent group, people very successful in their careers. They're smart guys. They understand that if you want people to go to Sunday school, you wedge it in between sacrament. If you want women to go to Relief Society, you stick it on Sunday. If you want people to wear temple garments, you come up with all sorts of weird sizes. You know, if you want people to continue being faithful to the teachings of the church, change the teaching of the church on birth control. Make the temple service shorter. I mean, you know, delete references that are offensive. I mean, these guys are smart. They get it. I think that if sacrament meeting attendance goes down, if young women leave the church in droves, change will happen. But one of the things I always have to be cautious with, there are things that I'd like to see changed in the church. I'm not sure those are necessary for the church to continue to grow and develop and be very successful. And I think that, especially in the era of President Hinckley, we're very concerned about our public image. You know, I don't know if this is really relevant, but my daughter was trying to decide where to go to school, and she got a heavy pitch from BYU, which I loved, had the best experience in the world. But looking at that recruiting video, I would have thought that 70% of the professors at BYU were female. I mean, I had one when I was there, and I was darn lucky I had one. And apparently some of them are leaving, and I think if enough female faculty members walk off, you know, then that'll signal. But again, I think they react like everyone else, and not the same way, but inspiration, I think, is prodded. You know, why was it 1978 before blacks got the priesthood? There are lots of ways. I'm not a psychologist or sociologist. There are lots of ways of looking at that. But eventually change happens, but it's usually in reaction to an insurmountable problem. So, did I answer your question? I don't know. Yeah, okay. We can have comments, too. This could be an open forum. I'd rather teach a class where we're interacting than give a boring paper.
Well, looking at your model of the growth cycle of the church, it seems that God had a great awareness of what kind of, quote, prophets or businessmen were needed at what time to get them past those stages. Academically, what do you foresee as... I was saying that tongue-in-cheek, okay.
Sure. No, I'll respond.
What do you foresee? I see that the church needs a decentralization where there's a lot of culture differences allowed and great leaders with charismatic forces in these smaller units. But what kind of leaders do you foresee in the future that you think would give the church a best chance of continued growth?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's like picking Supreme Court justices. You know, you never know what you got into, like the box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. President Hinckley was the first general authority I ever heard speak live, and I was enchanted with him. But I'll tell you, I always thought he was great. He had this presence, but I would have never predicted his ascendancy during President Kimball's ill health. Is that when he really started in it? And the wonderful job, and going on Larry King, I mean, give me a break. I never expected that. So you never know what's going to happen. But that's the last part of my paper. I said personality makes a difference. I don't know what these members of the I don't know what Dallin Oaks would be like as a president of the church. I don't know what Brother Nelson would be like. I think I know a president, acting president. Well, I won't mention his name. I think I know what that would be like. But if you want to have an activist God interpretation of things, yeah, I never liked the idea that he was like bumping off some apostles and preserving others so they become the present church. But I think that maybe leaders have arisen to fill the void. In many cases, we've had some fits and starts along the way, but really have risen to the occasion. And perhaps there is someone being prepared right now who is going to get down to core values, make church truly worldwide religion and allow discretion and give up some of the history. I mean, if there's one constant in the Mormon church, if you want to look at it really honestly, it's tremendous change. But we would not recognize a church meeting with Joseph Smith or with Brigham Young or maybe even with Joseph F. Smith. Anybody go to that presentation last year on Joseph F. Smith? fascinating. You know, if you talk about the Lord preserving someone, he was a hellion apparently when he was younger and had all sorts of problems and was sent to Hawaii to hopefully reform school and all the rest. When he ascended to become president, and you read some of his stuff, it's wonderful. And he seems very magnanimous and open. And when he talks about the need for charity and temperance and all the rest, he's speaking from experience. And I think he was prepared very well for that role, his core testimony notwithstanding. But maybe someone's being prepared right now. But I do really think it will take, because of the nature of the Mormon Church, someone with inspiration, with revelation, to change things. But boy, look at how gutsy it was for President Kimball. If you read any of the accounts of what was happening behind the scenes, boy, I tell you, I love that man. I mean, I was always inspired by President Kimball. He was my favorite. I went on a mission kind of early because of his, before I planned on doing it, because of his call, and I always felt, what a wonderful, but a gutsy person. He was just, and there are, you know, maybe it's going to take a real gutsy prophet to come along and do that. I don't know. Come on up.
We talk about organizational growth, and the assumption is that's synonymous with an increasing membership. It seems to me that the role of the church, rather than the bishop being there to protect the church from the members, the role of the church ought to be to enhance what the members are doing. And so to me, the growth of the church would be a diminishment of the organization and an enhancement of the individual. Is that possible in an organization?
Oh, boy. Well, you know, the first formal, not first formal, but one of the early formal interactions I had with Sunstone Symposium was working on a dialogue-sponsored session, and I gave one on a church organization paper, but one of the other speakers talked about organizations as a whole, and he made a point that I always bring up to my students, that is that whenever we join an organization, it's a great thing. We can accomplish a lot. We share resources. We help one another. We have a division of labor, all the rest, but we always give up something. There's a price to be paid for being part of an organization. To me, the church is not Salt Lake City. To me, the church is the people I go to Sunday worship service with and go on the scout hikes with and go to the service projects with and have elders' quorum parties with, and that's the church for me, the testimonies that are born mainly. And I think in terms of revitalization and thinking small, what better way than to say, we're going to be like the olden days where the bishops were kind of off by themselves and only got checked on every 6 months? You know, use your inspiration, internalize these values. Be like the Jesuits that were sent off to China or Japan or Central America or Africa. You know, maybe we'll see you before you die, but probably not. So go do your thing. That's a way of thinking small. And we always give up something when we join part of a large organization. But to me, the metaphor of the ward as a family is the greatest strength of Mormonism. It's the most wonderful part of the whole thing. And going to my daughter goes to institute at UCLA. She's missing out on that experience in college. I love that experience. I have my family home evening, brothers and sisters. I was actually a dad. I'm so proud of that. But we had instant friends and people who cared about you. You know, think about it. You can move anywhere almost in the world, and you got a babysitter on hand. You got somebody who's going to be your friend, go out to dinner with you, invite you over for dinner, help you. I remember moving to Salt Lake City, and I was here for a few months, and we had a professor move in right behind our house. And I said, oh, you're here? He said, yeah, I'm here in front of my family. I'm going to go try and hire some students to help move stuff. I said, that's all right. Let me go get some guys from the church. And by that Sunday afternoon, it was Oxenemeyer. We went and we moved him in his house. And what an impression that made. Couldn't believe it. And started their experience here in Salt Lake City on a very positive note. You know, the ward is wonderful. It's a wonderful thing. And people who I'm in a profession where people are pretty mobile. Go from campus to campus, and boy, they have hard times making connections and making friends. And boy, that's a wonderful part of the church. I just think thinking small to me translates into really emphasizing the authority of, I'm going to say, Relief Society president and bishop and young women's president and primary president and young, but emphasizing their authority. Get rid of this middle layer of bureaucracy, the stake. What good is a stake Sunday school president? I'm in the Sunday school presidents. I don't even know what the ward Sunday school does, but what do stake leaders do? I mean, there are temple recommends, I know, but is there anything that's vital? I don't think there is. And so, again, I'd like to see less emphasis on the structure of the church between the ward and maybe regional areas. I think that would be. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I'm rambling. Any parting shot before I sit down?
Yeah,
Do you have any comments?
I like him around.
Okay.